This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Ever find yourself dreaming about taking an adventurous vacation to some exotic location? Well, interest in adventure travel is booming. Vacations where you're a little or a lot out there, glimpsing or hanging on to the edge. Today on the Afternoon Magazine, we do a little dreaming. Journalist David Noland will be our guide. He is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the program. He can tell us about horseback riding in Mongolia, kayaking the fjords of Greenland, and bicycling through Vietnam. Your questions are welcome. You can join the conversation with a telephone call. If you're listening in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. David Noland has been around the world and written about his travels. His articles have appeared in the New York Times and Outside Magazine. He's the author of Travels Along the Edge, 40 Ultimate Adventures for the Modern Nomad, from crossing the Sahara to bicycling through Vietnam. Travels Along the Edge is published by Vintage Paperbacks. Questions, comments, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455 in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. David Noland, good afternoon. Welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to talk with you. So what has been your wildest adventure?
My wildest adventure?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. One of them was trekking in Sikkim in the Himalayas, and the wild moment didn't even happen on the trek. It happened on the bus getting to the trekking point. And our bus came very, very close to toppling off the edge of a cliff on one of those incredibly narrow, twisting dirt roads that are typical of the Himalayas.
Mm.
It was one of those moments when I really wanted to be home in bed. I kept imagining, you know, how the New York Times used to when they need a little one-inch filler story, it would always be about a bus plunge in Ceylon or a bus plunge in Nepal. And I could just see our bus making page three, one-sentence story in the New York Times. But fortunately, it didn't happen.
Good. We wouldn't be talking to you.
I guess we wouldn't.
So I hope you're safe and sound there in an armchair today.
Yes, I am. Sitting here at my desk, nice, beautiful fall day outside here. I live in the Hudson Valley of New York. So I've got the wood stove's cranking away, so I'm very comfortable.
Great. So these wild adventures, these adventures that get you on buses and on hairpin curves in far-off places in the world, why do you do it?
Why do people climb mountains? Because they're there. I just have a fascination, number one, with far-off places and cultures and different people, just seeing ways of life that are just so completely out of our own experience, I find fascinating and memorable. And then the second aspect of it for me is simply the physical aspect of being out, trekking in the Himalayas, walking along through some of the most beautiful scenery in the world and this brilliant fresh air at 15,000 feet, hiking, 6 or 8 hours a day. I can't think of much better.
Mm. As a child, were you interested in travel, in the writings of people who traveled the world, or did you in your family hike and camp and that kind of thing?
Well, I grew up in not far from you folks there in Indianapolis, I was kind of a conventional upper middle class suburban kid. But the thing that set us apart, and I think has had an effect on me, is we lived on a river, the White River, which flows through Indianapolis, and my whole life kind of revolved around the river, boating and canoeing and swimming. And I remember when I was about 14, my next-door neighbor and I took a five-day canoe trip. We just paddled away from our docks that were in our front yard, and our parents met us 5 days downstream. So I guess living on the river probably planted this seed.
Mm.
And then when I was 17, my senior year in high school, my father was a businessman, and his company transferred him over to London for a year. So our family moved to London when I was 17. And that really opened my eyes, for a Midwestern suburban kid in the early 60s, back in Beaver Cleaver days. It was quite something to suddenly be transported into a whole different world, and it did open my eyes and teach me that there are different ways of doing things that are as good or in some cases better than the way we do them here. So that, I think, those were the two significant childhood things that set me on the path of traveling.
Yeah. There's an adventure here that takes place in England in your book.
Yes, it's called the Coast to Coast Walk. You literally walk across the entire country. It's up in the north, just below the Scottish border. So it's probably one of the narrowest parts of England. But it takes, I believe, it's about 10 to 12 days of walking through some of the most beautiful parts of England, the Lake District and the Yorkshire Dales, and some of the gloomy moors up there. So it's quite a walk.
Mm. How did you select the trips that you included in Travels Along the Edge?
Well, part of it was if I had done it, that was certainly a big contributing factor, because obviously you can write much better about a trip that you've done yourself or a place you've been. But I did not do all 40 of the trips I write about. I think I counted up recently, and I ended up doing about 18 of the 40. And of the other 22, part of it was a matter of just geographic balance. I wanted to get an equal spread of countries around the world. I have 8 trips on each of the 5 major continents or continental areas. So part of it was balancing in that way, and part of it was balancing it in terms of activities. I wanted to get a variety of trekking and sea kayaking, mountain climbing, bicycling, that sort of thing. So it was sort of filling slots with trips that I had read about that just somehow caught my eye or just seemed interesting.
It was interesting to me to look through the book and see that some of the trips, some of these adventures, take a lot of physical stamina and some skill. And others, the test really is, the adventure is in your mind in terms of, do you have what it takes to make it? Not that it's physically demanding, but mentally it can be very demanding.
Yes, and this is one of the things I point out. And before we go too much further, I think we should point out to the listeners that all the trips I write about are organized, outfitted group trips that are run by outfitters,
mm-hmm.
where all the logistics are taken care of. And essentially, you call a toll-free number, give them your credit card, and show up at the airport. And, the outfitters take care of all the logistics. So these are all trips that not only can be done physically and mentally by many people, but they're also easy to do logistically because all that's taken care of.
All the details are taken care of. Although I would not be so quick to say they're easy.
Well, logistically.
Logistically, yes. Okay.
You don't have to, make 17 phone calls to Pakistan to get your trekking permit and to, reserve a guide and figure out where to go, that sort of thing. The outfitter does all that sort of thing.
Mm.
But, no, you're right. The outfitter gets you there and puts you in a position to do these things, but you still have to do them yourself.
Yeah, and you also have to work really in cooperation with that outfitter. You've got to, you make it very clear at the outset that you really need to know what you're getting into, and you also need to pay attention to the expert.
Right, and that's one of the reasons I rate each trip on a scale of 1 to 5, both in terms of its physical challenge and also its mental challenge, as you mentioned. And those are two different things. Some trips that I write about are physically quite easy. For example, going to Antarctica, cruising to Antarctica, requires no physical requirement whatsoever. You you're on a small expedition cruise ship. You'll go ashore in small rafts and walk around on shore. But if you have some bad luck, it's going to take some mental toughness to survive this trip, because to get to Antarctica and to get back from Antarctica, you have to cross the Drake Passage, the dreaded Drake Passage, which is notorious for having the roughest water on the face of the earth. So if the Drake Passage is in a foul mood for the 2 days you're going over or coming back, your ship is going to be rocking and rolling, and you're going to be sick and pretty unhappy for 2 days nonstop, mm-hmm. with no hope of relief. So that sort of thing takes a certain mental approach, a certain mental toughness. And many of the trips are not so much physically demanding as mentally demanding.
Yeah. My favorite for mentally demanding is the trip in Ethiopia rafting down the Omo. This is a trip not for the medically faint of heart.
Right. This part of Ethiopia is perhaps the most disease-ridden part of the world. I was talking to a tropical disease expert who had taken a raft trip down the Omo in Ethiopia, and he was positively giddy when he was talking about this area. He said, "Oh, it's great! You can catch every single disease in Africa, with one exception. You know, everything there in Ethiopia. It's a wonderful place." There are some strange diseases to be caught there, but the odds against it are virtually everyone who comes back from that trip does not suffer any long-term ill effects. But, you know, there are tsetse flies and sleeping sickness and all sorts of strange larvae and worms and parasites. You definitely need to have a certain attitude to take that trip.
Mm. One of my favorites for something that is both dangerous and involves some physical stamina and also a really sound mental approach is skiing to the North Pole.
Yes, that's. I would probably rate that of the 40 trips. That was probably the second most difficult mentally in the book. And you don't ski all the way to the North Pole. The way it works is you take a charter plane, a Twin Otter ski plane, flies you and a team of dog sleds, or a team of dogs and sleds and skis, and lands on the ice pack approximately 100 miles south of the pole. And you then ski the final 100 miles, which takes anywhere from 7 to 10 days. And you are out there, obviously, completely on your own, and you're walking across basically just ice. There's no land. There's no dry land up there. You're walking across ice. And it's done in the spring when the weather is warm enough to be bearable. But the problem is the ice is starting to melt a little bit, starting to break up a bit. So you have cracks opening up, and the ice is moving around and piling up into what they call pressure ridges. And there is a very real possibility that you may fall through the ice into water that is 29 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, people ask, how can you have water that's below the freezing point? Well, salt water freezes at about 29 degrees. So you literally have a chance of falling through. And the outfitter who runs this trip prepares you for this eventuality. They have a midwinter training camp in northern Minnesota that lasts for about a week to get you prepared for this trip. And one of the things you are required to do is they take everyone out on the ice on a frozen lake in Minnesota, and they chainsaw a hole in the ice. It's usually about a foot thick. And then you are ordered to jump into the water fully clothed. And you do that, and then they pull you out, and you're taught how to roll around, you know, to pull yourself out of the water and roll around in the snow, and then quickly change clothes, get into dry clothes, and get into a tent. And basically, it's a dress rehearsal for the ultimate calamity that could happen on the trip. Mm-hmm. So that certainly takes a certain mental attitude to do that. I'm not sure I personally would be up for that trip.
There's a little comfort there for me to hear that from you.
Yeah, you know, we have a scale, as I said, a scale of 1 to 5, and I would rate myself as kind of about a 3 to 4 guy. You know, maybe 4 at tops, but I'm comfortable as about a level 3 guy.
I'm a level 2 to 3 gal.
Okay, well, there's plenty of trips in the book for you then.
Yeah, but I want to go back to skiing to the North Pole. My heart was going for these folks out there. You had me just right there with them. On their way, they were so set on, you know, they'd done all this preparation, and they were so set on trying to make that goal to get to the pole. And the frustrating thing is that, you know, you say 100 miles over 10 days, you know. You know, 10 miles a day, right?
Right, right.
But the trouble is with the ice shifting, you can take a nap, and when you wake up, you've lost 3 or 4 miles.
Exactly, yeah. The ice is floating around, and the currents were against them. So every time they stopped, they lost a little ground. And what it made it truly dramatic, and what I describe in the chapter is the very first trip that this outfitter made with paying customers back in, I believe it was 1994, was that they had the plane comes to pick them up after they reach the pole, and there's an agreed upon landing site very close to the pole. I believe it's about 10 miles away, and they received a radio call from the pilot saying there was a big storm moving in and that they absolutely had to be at this place at a certain time or they would be left behind. And obviously that's not a place you want to be left behind in the middle of the Arctic Ocean. So this group fought this what appeared to be a losing battle against time, because the mathematics of the whole thing were pitiless. They knew exactly where they were. They knew how far they had to go. They knew what time they had to be back to meet the plane, and they knew how fast they could go. And at a certain point, they realized that they couldn't make it. They had to turn around, and they were literally only about 1 mile, 1 or 2 miles from the pole. Something they'd been, you know, training for months and, you know, slogging their guts out for 10 days to get to. And they came to the realization they were going to have to turn around 1 mile short. And then, like a stroke of lightning from heaven, they saw a helicopter above them. And of course, at first they were just absolutely astonished, because what is this helicopter doing, you know, 2,000 miles from the nearest land?
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out there was a party of German tourists who had hired a Russian helicopter to helicopter them to the North Pole. So the trip leader made a split-second decision that they were going to make a dash to the pole, pray that they could talk the helicopter guy into helicoptering them back to pick up their plane. And it was basically a life-or-death decision, because if, in fact, that did not happen, they would be left behind in this huge storm by the pilots. And maybe I shouldn't reveal the ending. I guess we can. They all survived.
There's plenty of other adventures to catch your attention here.
It turned out the trip leader was an old buddy of the helicopter pilot from a previous polar expedition he'd done. So everything worked out, and the people made the pole. And, in fact, they even had champagne and hors d'oeuvres at the pole, courtesy of the German tourists. Jumped in the helicopter, flew 10 miles back to their landing strip, and met their plane and made it home safely just before the storm moved in.
You know, thinking of, and this isn't to put the German tour down at all, but those folks were like a 1 on the you know, physical demands and a 1 on the mental demands in terms of their expedition.
Right. Well, I'd say maybe a little more than a 1. I think riding a helicopter for, you know, several hours over the Arctic Ocean would rate a little more than a 1, maybe a 2 or 3. But certainly physically, it's only a 1. I mean, they just sat there.
Yeah.
And the skiers reported that when they skied up to this party who had helicoptered in, that they could see the look of astonishment and awe and admiration in the Germans' eyes, that, my God, you know, these people actually skied here. So, you know, they all felt sort of smugly superior to these tourists who helicoptered in.
And these folks bless them, the folks that skied to the North Pole. They could be our neighbors.
They could be. They were not. These were not superhuman people. They were from all walks of life. In fact, one of the people, one of the women on the trip, claimed. I talked to her. She claimed she had never slept outdoors in a sleeping bag before in her life.
Hmm.
But she had the right stuff mentally, and she, you know, made it through the boot camp training session in Minnesota. Which a number of people didn't. That was one of the purposes of that boot camp as well, was to not only train people, but to find out who had the mental toughness to do this. And a number of people didn't. They dropped out. Presumably, many of them right before they were ordered to jump into the into the frozen lake.
You know, I think that Paul Shirky and Rick Schweitzer, these are the two outfitters in this adventure, and. Do they ever do that prep course as an adventure in itself, you know, so that someone like myself could go and do that with them in Minnesota as a kind of a camping survival wintertime adventure without having to actually follow through and ski to the North Pole?
I know they do have winter survival courses. Now, I don't think they involve jumping into the lake fully clothed. But I'm sure that if you really wanted to do that, you could call them and you could go through that training camp. I'm sure they'd be agreeable to that.
David Noland is our guest. We're talking with him about his book, Travels Along the Edge, 40 Ultimate Adventures for the Modern Nomad, from crossing the Sahara to bicycling through Vietnam. It's published by Vintage Paperbacks. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. If you'd like to talk with us this afternoon, give us a call. 1-800-222-9455 is our toll-free number. You can also call us if you're listening in Champaign-Urbana on the local line 333-9455. Well, after talking about skiing to the North Pole, maybe we could talk about something that would be not quite so strenuous. There's a number of things in the book. Probably the easiest one, tell me if I'm right or wrong, and it sounds like it would be a wonderful adventure, Africa, riding elephants in Botswana.
Right. I would say that and cruising along the coast of Turkey are probably the two easiest physical trips in the book. The riding the elephants in Botswana is... I unfortunately was not able to do that myself, but from talking to people who've done it, it's an amazing experience. You spend a week at a very, very remote camp in the Okavango Delta, and you go out on safari every day, not in a land cruiser, but on top of an elephant. And as you can imagine, there is no better safari game viewing vehicle than an elephant. The visibility, of course, is superb. The traction is superb. They're not going to get bogged down in the swamp. And, of course, the great advantage is that they don't spook the animals. And the animals in this area are not accustomed to humans, so the sight of a jeep tends to spook them. But the sight of an elephant, it's, so what, another elephant.
And it's relatively safe and relatively comfortable to ride an elephant?
Yeah. They have big, nice, soft saddles on them, and the elephants themselves are extremely well-trained. The elephant story is an interesting one. They're all owned by a fellow named Randall Moore, an American guy, who became, I guess you could say, obsessed with elephants as a young man, and... decided he wanted to reintroduce American zoo elephants back to Africa. He became obsessed with this idea. And the animals that you will be riding here are all former American or, I believe there's one Canadian, zoo or animal park elephants. And there are also a couple of orphaned elephants from Kruger National Park in South Africa, where they have so many elephants that they have to occasionally cull them to keep the population down. And when they kill an adult, often there's a baby elephant left as an orphan. So a couple of the elephants at places called Abu's camp, a couple of the elephants there are Kruger orphans. But all of these elephants have been trained extensively by Moore to be ridden. And as far as I know, they're the only African elephants in the world that can be ridden. You know, Indian elephants are quite commonly ridden. You know, they're used as beasts of burden used to be all over Southeast Asia. So it's not a big deal to ride an Indian elephant. But as far as I know, these are the only African elephants that are actually rideable.
Hmm. I think that would be one of the ultimate wildlife experiences.
Exactly, and the people I talked to who took this trip said, you know, it wasn't the wildlife we saw that will stay with me for the rest of my life. We saw wonderful wildlife, but that's not what I remember. What I remember is riding these elephants, living with these elephants, because they live right in camp with you. And each of these elephants has a very distinct, strong personality, and they interrelate with the guests. And, you know, by the time the week is over, virtually every guest is just madly in love with these elephants and can hardly bear to leave them because they are so intelligent and gentle and well socialized. It's really like almost they're great big people, almost in a certain way. They're so human-like and they relate so well to people. So that's what people take away from that experience, is not seeing giraffes, but just simply hanging around camp with a bunch of elephants. Mm.
Let's take a call. We've got a listener waiting to talk with us on line one. Hi.
Hello. I was wondering if your guest had any information about traveling in the Balkans or even Turkey, say?
Well, yes, there's a trip in the book, cruising along the coast of Turkey in these old traditional wooden sailing ships called goulets, and you stop along the way, you know, swimming and snorkeling along the beaches, and also walking up to historical ruins, ancient Roman and Greek ruins. It's one of the most historic areas in the whole world, the Turkish coast. And the Balkans, I don't write about anything in the book, but I just read recently there someone has just started a cruise along the coast of Croatia, stopping at Dubrovnik and some of the offshore islands there that are pretty much untouched by the Balkan War at this point. But yeah, right now, vacationing in the Balkans is a pretty iffy thing. It's not your vacation paradise.
No. Can I ask one more question?
Sure.
I was wondering, what would be, say you were traveling in the quotation marks third world, what would you think of as the most useful item that you could carry, like carry with you, if you were, say you were alone?
Oh, wow. Well, I think a lot depends on the country. Oh, boy, it's hard to say. Obviously a good backpack. I mean, just, having to carry stuff by hand would just be, very annoying. I would say having a really good backpack that fits you extremely well and carries a lot of weight easily would be very important. But in terms of cultural things, there are some countries where people love a color picture of the Dalai Lama, Tibet, for example. Little things like that that vary from country to country. So it's really hard to say. I think it very much depends on precisely where you are, mm-hmm. in terms of little, little offbeat things like that might help you out.
I've heard needles were very good. Are you just sewing needles? Were good to carry in certain countries.
I've not heard that, but that could very well be true.
They're easy to carry, of course.
I know the kids in Nepal, as you walk along the trail, are always asking you for pens. I don't know why. You'd think they'd be asking for candy or something like that, but they always are saying pen. So if you want to make a Nepalese kid happy, carry some ballpoint pens along to give them.
I'll keep that in mind if I ever get over there. Nice talking to you.
Okay.
Take care. Bye.
Thanks for your call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome. 333-9455 is the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, you can call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. David Noland is our guest. He's the author of Travels Along the Edge, and we're talking about adventure travel this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine. David, this is the fastest growing segment of the travel industry?
Yes, I'm not alone in my love for this sort of thing. People are getting tired of, you know, the same old Disney World, or, you know, a week on a beach in Caribbean, or the museum tour of Europe. People are looking, I think, to stretch themselves a little bit more, to push their limits a bit.
And with today's technologies, from global positioning satellite technology to the ability to, you know, travel to Antarctic fairly simply, that's got to be part of it. Also, I'm surprised.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I think the main reason for the growth of this is so easy to do it now. I mean, literally a toll-free phone call and a credit card will get you practically anywhere in the world. You know, the rise of these outfitters who do all the logistics certainly were responsible for me starting to do this sort of thing. I remember the first trip I ever took was to Mount Kilimanjaro in Africa, and I'd always had a vague longing to do this sort of thing before that, but it just seemed so completely out of reach, you know, logistically. I didn't even know where to begin. You know, how do I climb Mount Kilimanjaro? But then one day I was paging through a catalog from a company called Mountain Travel, and there it was, a picture of Mount Kilimanjaro, and here's the number to call, and they do all the logistics. And so I called the number, and boy, I must say, as soon as I hung up, I said, my God, what have I done? That was almost too easy.
You handed over your credit card number, and you were on your way.
Yeah.
Let's take another call, and then when we come back, I do want to ask you some questions about selecting an outfitter. So let's go to our next caller this afternoon on line one. Hi.
Hi. I was going to ask about that just now. I took a coast-to-coast with the Sierra Club, and I was curious to know who you recommend in your book.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't really recommend one outfitter over the other. What I do is list each outfitter who does the trip and describe their itinerary and the price and that sort of thing, and pretty much leave it up to you to decide. Now, I do not include any outfitters that I have any reason to believe are not, you know, 100% legitimate and competent. But it's an interesting point, because there are three outfitters that offer that same trip, that England coast to coast, and they all have different approaches, and basically you need to find out more about each trip and then select the one you want. There's a British outfitter that runs that trip that you walk every mile. You literally go every step coast to coast, and it's a fairly difficult march. It takes about 12 days, and you're averaging maybe 14 miles a day, and there are some days that are up to 20 miles. So it's a pretty challenging trip. Sierra Club was sort of right in the middle. I think instead of covering the entire 120 miles, they might have covered about 90 miles of it, and their mileage averaged maybe 10 to 11 miles per day. And then a third outfitter, Wilderness Travel, their version of the trip covers only about 90 of the 120 miles. There are certain sections they think are just not scenic enough to worry about. And, they average maybe only 8 or 9 miles per day. So there are three different physical levels that you can choose among these outfitters. And there's also differences in the luxuriousness of the places you stay at. Wilderness Travel selects very posh, nice places to stay, whereas the British outfitter, Sherpa Expeditions, chooses more basic places. And obviously their trip costs much less. So there's three options you have there, kind of the ranging from easy to difficult, from rustic to plush, and the price difference is significant. So all that information is laid out, and it's up to you to kind of choose the one you want. All three are excellent outfitters who do wonderful trips, but you got to choose the one that suits you.
Well, I like to recommend the Sierra Club because I thought that was a wonderful trip. And
was Lou Wilkinson your...
Yes.
Yeah, I talked to Lou during the research of the book. He's a great guy.
Yes. And what was interesting is there were about 14 people plus the guides, and I think a lot of them were in their 70s.
Yeah. It's surprising how this is not necessarily a young man's game. In fact, one company, Mountain Travel, did a survey of their customers and found that the average age was, I think, late 40s. So a lot of these, you know, trips are focused toward sort of the baby boomer types who are still fit. A lot of us still jog and are very active.
Yeah.
But we still like to come back to a nice place at night sometimes.
Yeah. Well, there was a wide age range, but,
That's the thing about most of these trips. Anybody from 20 to 60 or 70 can do these. I remember when I climbed Kilimanjaro, we had a guy who was 63 on the trip, and he made the summit without a problem.
Wow. Well, Lou was in his 70s.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, when he led it. And you stay two nights at each place, at bed and breakfast mostly, which is nice in a way.
Right.
Yeah,
it's nice for some people. Other people like the purity of simply walking coast to coast in a straight line without
digressing.
Without digressing, exactly. And the purists prefer that way of doing it, making it a real project and covering every foot. And for those people, Sherpa Expeditions is the outfitter to go with.
Yeah.
Because they cover every foot of the way.
What's the name of your book?
It's called Travels Along the Edge.
Okay, and your name?
David Noland.
Okay. Is that K-N or N-O?
N-O-L-A-N-D.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. There's an expedition or an adventure vacation in Travels Along the Edge in Italy, in the Italian Alps. And it appeared to me, reading through that there might be a difference between outfitters in which way they take you, because one of the outfitters, and I can't remember off the top of my head now, what one of the outfitters you said described its route as being a bit airy.
Right, and did not recommend its trip for people with a fear of heights. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's another thing to think of. I think I list six or seven outfitters who do hiking trips in the Dolomites in northern Italy. And some, they all take different routes, and that's a thing you should look into and then see how difficult the routes are. Another thing to consider on that Dolomites trip, some outfitters put you up in the refugios, which are the mountain huts. They're fairly rustic places, although they have food and heat and warm beds. Other outfitters prefer to use full-service hotels in the villages. So those are the things you consider about each outfitter before you choose one.
Yeah. Now, you write here, none of these trips, I found the chapter on Italy, none of these trips requires negotiating the notorious Via Ferrata, the Iron Way. The steel cables and ladders that have been permanently fixed throughout the Dolomites to help hikers up and down steep terrain that would normally require mountaineering gear. Now, is there an outfit that would make use of, would make this trip more difficult, more challenging, and where you would use the notorious Via Ferrata?
Not that I'm aware of.
That sounds a little spooky.
Yeah, well, the great thing about the Dolomites is that's one trip that it's pretty easy to do on your own. Many of the trips I write about are virtually impossible to do on your own. Doing it with a group is about the only way, going to Antarctica, for example, or skiing to the North Pole. The one in the Dolomites is one that can easily be done on your own without an outfitter. And if you you want to try the Via Ferrata, then I would, you know, you, it's quite easy to do it on your own.
Mm.
You can arrange to stay in the huts yourself, and the trails are very well marked, and there are good maps, and you wouldn't really need a guide.
Mm.
So if you're looking for a thrill on the Via Ferrata,
I'm kind of interested in that. Maybe one of these days, huh?
Yeah, the Dolomites are beautiful. They're so underappreciated and unknown by Americans. It's hard to imagine. I was there for 4 days, and I must have passed 1,000 hikers, and I never once saw another American.
Hmm. In the trips where you are together in a group of folks, can that be difficult in terms of being put in a group? You don't know anyone until you're there, and sometimes the situation can be a little dicey in terms of, you know, it's a long day, you're either walking or bicycling a long distance, or
right.
The challenges physically are stiff.
Well, I think it all depends on the person. I personally enjoy the group situations. I've met a lot of wonderful people and met some lifelong friends in these group situations. You do get an occasional jerk. There's no doubt about it. But I found that the jerk ratio on these trips is generally lower than it is in everyday life. So, but when you do get a jerk, I found in most cases it's really easy to avoid him or her. If you're on a trek, you simply walk ahead of them or walk behind them, or if you're on a bike trip, you go at your own pace. And many of these trips, you're kind of, you can be as alone as you want to during the day. Now, of course, in the evening, you're going to be eating and hanging out with these people. But if you're not a group type person, then maybe you should mm-hmm. consider these trips. There's one good friend of mine who I've been trying to persuade to go with me on one of these trips for years, and he just refuses. He just says, I just don't want to take the chance of, being stuck with somebody I don't like. And, to me, that's not a very flexible attitude, and that's part of that mental attitude you need to go on these trips, of being very flexible,
mm-hmm.
easygoing, sense of humor, able to cope with things when they don't quite go your way all the time. Bad weather, being uncomfortable, and part of that attitude is simply dealing with jerks. If being around a jerk ruins your whole day, then stay home or go on your own. But for those of us who are a little more flexible and easygoing and can simply put up with them now and then, to me the rewards of the group experience are far greater. For every jerk I've met 50 terrific people, and I've got a dozen people that I'm still in touch with and good friends with years later.
Yeah, I would imagine that, generally speaking, making a generalization here, that whiners are not going to be attracted to making this kind of
exactly.
A trek.
They tend to self-select out of these trips. Whiners don't want to do this sort of thing.
Yeah.
So you kind of the trips themselves filter out most of the whiners. And you mentioned the physical difficulty. I've found that the more challenging and difficult the trip, the more the group bonds together. And it can be a real bonding experience to go through something very difficult with a small group of people over a long period of time. Really, really brings you together. Mm-hmm. And when our group climbed Kilimanjaro, we had five of us made the summit, and it was a very difficult, grueling experience. 5-day climb, and all five of us, this is 10 years later, we're all still in touch, and a couple of them I would call good friends, and in fact we even had a reunion back at my house a couple of years later, and one guy came all the way from Australia to be at this reunion.
Mm.
So going through these difficult either physical or mental trips can really bond you with people. It's a wonderful thing.
I have to ask you before we leave, the book Travels Along the Edge is dedicated to Lisa Liu, who I assume is your significant other, your partner,
right,
who keeps the home fires burning, you write.
Right.
Is Lisa Liu an adventurer?
She's a semi-adventurer. She has gone on a few of the easy runs with me. In fact, she organized a trip that we took to the jungles of Trinidad and Tobago, and that was great fun. And we've been to Hawaii, but not your normal Hawaii vacation. We spent the whole time hiking around volcanoes and paddling sea kayaks up rivers to waterfalls, things like that. So, yeah, I'd call her a semi-adventurer. She's not ready to climb Kilimanjaro, but
she keeps the home fires burning.
She does, and then that's without her, I wouldn't be traveling nearly as much as I do.
Every Ulysses needs Lisa Liu.
Absolutely.
David, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
It's been a pleasure. David Noland has been our guest. Noland. His book travels along the Edge 40 Ultimate Adventures for the Modern Nomad, from crossing the Sahara to bicycling through Vietnam. It's a vintage paperback.